morning, honorable members. This is a very strange venue. Yes, I just feel like we're in a weird place. Committees are meeting, okay. And I was hoping the EFF would arrive. Doesn't look like they are on their way. For me, I want proper coffee. Are there any apologies?
Ma'am, we've received only one apology from Ms. Kubai.
Ms. Kubai, and we note the Honorable Chief Whip of the... Okay. All right. Can we look at the agenda? Honorable Roto.
Thank you, Speaker. I want to apologize on behalf of the House Chairperson Frolic, who's out in the country. Frolic.
Okay, can we then look at the agenda? Is there anything else? It's mainly the report of the subcommittee and the issues tabled by the Chief Whip. Mini plenary, order of proceedings. So that's a full agenda. If we're agreeing with this agenda, can we then proceed to minutes of the meeting of the 6th September and go through them quickly? First page, page 2. Page 3.
Honorable Speaker, are we doing corrections? Pardon? Are we doing corrections?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think page 1 I had tendered my apology. So it's
that
not
needs to be reflected.
Recorded, yeah. It was a day after my birthday, so I had a babalas of the record.
Everyone has a right to have one once in a blue moon. Oh, it is captured. Yeah, okay. Page 3. Page 4. Five. Six. So, may I now have a motion for the adoption of the minutes? Is the correct record? Deputy Chief Whip moved. Is there a seconder? Honorable Mdagane seconds. There is no objection. The minutes have been adopted as a correct record. Matters arising. Masulele, can you take us through?
Ma'am, these issues that would have been metal all conversed in the report of the subcommittee that is on the agenda.
So can we just move to item 5, and that is the report of the subcommittee on review of assembly rules. Honorable Mdagane.
Honorable Speaker. The task team of the Rules Committee met on the 14th of October to look at the matters that were referred to us by the Rules Committee. And then it's on page 1 of the document, I think it's circulated to all members. Procedure for motion without notice is a matter that was referred to us to look at it. We had a long discussion, Honorable Speaker, on this matter. And then we have made some proposals that will appear in terms of page 2. That's what we want to propose. That's a proposal that we are making there, because the Rules Committee raised an issue that we should try to be specific on how these five parties that we are talking about, but mainly is the opposite, is the governing party and the largest minority party, and three other parties. Then three other parties means any other party. There are 13 parties in the National Assembly, as far as I know. That the ANC and the DA, if there's a motion without notice that is presented for consideration, firstly, these five parties, the ANC, the National, the DA, and three other parties of the National Assembly, they will indicate 30 minutes before the sitting to the National Assembly Secretary whether they object to the motion without notice that we presented. If, of course, they do object, that motion won't be read by a member in the chamber, then simply means that motion will fall out. But bearing in mind that Rule 123, there are guidelines in the rules, what is the motion without notice? It's very explained. This one is just to, these are guidelines for the ease implementation of the rules. You may not find some of the issues in the rules, but the rules are not going to be so detailed. The guidelines are there to assist us to interpret the rules correctly in terms of implementation of the rules. That is, Roman Figure 1 is a matter that we have thought we have agreed in the subcommittee. That is very important for us to avoid people coming to the chamber, reading a motion, insulting parties, insulting individuals. We thought that the best thing to do is not an attempt to censor anyone. All members of parliament had a free speech, but to accept one issue, that at least these two parties, broadly speaking, other three parties, that alternatively anyway, can be any other three parties. If they all agree that, you know, we think this motion is not problematic in terms of the Rule 123, criteria were followed, they accept it. Then a member who's proposing that will read it in the chamber. But if the party says no, then the motion won't be read in the chamber. And then once it's not read in the chamber because the party has not agreed, then it's one that we are taking a point on. We think that one alone can really deal with the matter that we're dealing with, because I think the Rules Committee, generally speaking, agreed with a broad framework of five parties. But they were saying that you must be specific whether these parties have, just to use it wrongly, veto right in as members of parliament to say that if they don't agree on this matter, therefore the matter doesn't come to the assembly. Then we thought that would enhance the decorum of the house, that people don't read something that is so insulting to other members of their chamber without presenting a substantive motion, even if at the end you reject it, but already statement has been made, to ensure that we protect the integrity of parliament and decorum of the house. We thought this can be the way out. There's also sub 2. Sub 2 really was a legalistic issue, generally. That the first point that we raised is that, in our view, as a subcommittee, that all members of parliament who are here are not free agents. They are members of parties. It would be very rare when the Honorable Steenhuisen says, we don't support this motion, a member of a DA stand up and say, no, I support this motion. It's very rare that we have. But also to cover that members of parliament as individual members, they are here. They're also covered and protected. Therefore, if there's one member who simply out of the party line take a view that I don't agree with this motion, that motion won't be put to the House for 40. And that motion then will be just taken out, and then a member will be requested, if so wishes, to represent that motion as a motion with notice. We thought this can cover all of us and be happy with this approach. We thought that that's how we should try to deal with the issue of a motion without notice, because we have suspended now motion without notice until we accept this. And then our view in the subcommittee is that that's what we can propose for the Rules Committee to consider, And if the amendment that are proposed by the Rules Committee, I think we are fine with that. But we are preferring one, Roman Figure 1. Roman Figure 2 only came as a result of, say, members of Parliament as individual members, also they do have a right. Though we are party, at least a proportional representation. But if one member rise up, it's very difficult to say, no, can't say this thing because it will be difficult on that. That we should cover with Roman Figure 2. That's what you are proposing for consideration, Honorable Speaker. All other matters really as they follow on Chapter 3, generally, there are no issues there. Removal of the Speaker or Deputy Speaker, we think is a procedural issue. We have agreed on that as a subcommittee. We want to propose that these guidelines in terms of Chapter 3, in terms of presiding officers and members, and then until the end, until 6, sub 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6, we have looked at it. We have taken a view, really, that it doesn't cause harm. And then it's an issue that is very clear. The rule is there. They've been accepted by the chamber. The guidelines are there to make it easy for presiding officers to implement the rules. Guidelines are not there to take over from the rules, but they are there to make it easy to do that. We found that the two on page 3 is appointment of responsible whips. On this issue, Red was just explaining how the rule is assisting us to deal with this matter. Of course, parties can come together. If the parties come together, that is two, that is on page 3, appointment and responsibility of whips. That is Rule 33.3a. And then that rule, really, we have expanded that, that if parties who don't qualify to have a whip because they are less than 6, they can come together, go to the speaker, sign, of course, go to the speaker, request the speaker to consider their request. If the speaker agrees with them, then that's how it should happen in terms of the guidelines. And then we think that doesn't cause problem for parties. I think they can accept that. Of course, the view that we're saying that whose guide anyway, individual simply signing, at least the leader of the party must sign. And then the letter go to the speaker, this is what you are requesting. The speaker meet with them, have a discussion with them, if she agrees, the names are given to the speaker then table them to the ATC. We thought that is the situation almost that we are doing right now. Because it's one week per 6 members. Those parties that have less than that, they have to apply. We thought that is not a big issue as far as we are concerned in the subcommittee. And on the issue, I think the party appointment, all the issue really, even Rule 33.1 on page 4, determination of the number of whips to be allocated to parties represented, the view really at the time that we should reconfirm that is 1 into 6. That we should not change, that we should accept it. Those parties who don't have qualified together, already they are doing that, the speaker can look at it and endorse it. On Chapter 6, decisions on questions. This one is a voting manual system and electronic voting. When we look at it, we thought that we must just clarify the procedure and process to be followed. There was no big issue about that amongst ourselves. I think we agreed on an electronic voting system. Manual will only come, of course, sometimes the system doesn't work. And then the manual then is proposed, and this is a procedure if you want the manual voting system to come. I don't think in areas where there were no disagreement or emphasis, I would really read it in details. I think I'll be consuming much of your time. On Chapter 10, editing of questions. The point that we're raising there, that question, that is page 6, Chapter 10 is 1. Editing of questions, that is Rule 134.6. On that area, really, that when questions are edited, are not about the content, sometimes about the language, that ensuring that are not offensive, there's a rule that explains exactly how the criteria of this question will be approved. Therefore, on this area, really, we thought that there would be no problem to propose what we are proposing. We have worked on it. The task team was the subcommittee, consider all the points from object of the question. We tried to explain what is the parliamentary question all about. And we had a discussion yesterday in the chamber about some of these issues. We have then moved on the general form and content of questions. We have explained what we think is the general form and the form and content of questions. And two, on page 7, a question is not permissible which contains, then we have explained why the question cannot be acceptable. It's not just because of political judgment. It's just the question must not have or contain offensive expression, all the matters that we have highlighted there, that we can't accept a question that is insulting, integrity of a member Singh and other members on that. We agreed as a subcommittee that we should propose this for the consideration of the House, that is from 2A to 2H, that we should consider that because we think there's no bigger issues there. Then is an issue on page 8, is 3 there on the top of the page, question may not. That's an issue really, it's almost a criteria that you are putting forward. But you are not replacing the rules. The rules are there, they won't be, of course the rule always takes precedence. But these guidelines are not taking over from the rules, are assisting us as members of parliament to understand exactly if the office of the speaker says that particular question is out of order, what are the guidelines that will make them to arrive at that decision? That's what we are trying for, is implementation of the rules. And question may not, one point that we are raising, A, express an opinion or seek expression of one. There are five sub-issues there, A, B, C, and D. When we're looking at it, really, we thought that it's important also to protect the decorum of the House, and we must ensure that we work in a manner that is consistent with the Constitution. This is not undermining the freedom of speech of individual members of Parliament, but it's giving just a guideline. So what is it that is acceptable on that? The task team, when we look at it, we have a long debate on this matter, but at the end, I think we agree that we should put here for your consideration. At 4, really, the question may not, those are the issues that we are raising there, is A to I. But to I would say be a repeat of other questions with same trivial variation. That you put a question and you see you just change is and was and has been and then still put the same question like that. We thought that can't work. Then there should be other issues there because the starting point with that question mechanism is there to assist members of parliament to hold the executive accountable. Then we can't pose one question just changing the language here and there, but the content is still the same, the form still the same. We thought that is an issue that we are raising now. And then that's why we put there in J on page 9 that it is what we call be trivial, vague, meaningless. And we're trying again to be sure that Honorable Waters, the questions are taken care of when members of executive are there. They know exactly what is this question all about in order for them to assist us answering those questions. On 5, really, we were just raising at what we call basic tenet of all questions, that a question should be related to the cabinet member official responsibility. Then we have highlighted A to, I think it's A to L. We have highlighted all the areas there that the question can be, if you're a minister of mineral resources, whatever, at least the question that goes to that minister should be about the area that the minister is assigned to, rather than just a general question that doesn't assist in the minister. Because if the question is not specific, sometimes it's difficult for members of the executive to answer questions like that. That's what we are proposing when we look at it. We thought that this in terms of the guidelines. These are guidelines, not the rules. We can change the guidelines from time to time, but it's difficult to change the rules because you need majority of members. I think it happened yesterday. We need a majority of members because we didn't want members to change the rules from time to time. Otherwise, the rules then lose the respect of the House. On page 10, these are questions then to President. Form and content of question to the president. We are raising a point there, one, and then general, what is the criteria that we'll use? But the two were raising their hand that the president represents the executive authority of the republic, and then, of course, he can delegate responsibility to members of the cabinet. And then the entire issue, though, is that when you delegate, you don't abdicate the overall responsibility. That's why we are raising that point. But you also try to be very specific on issues. Question to the president may relate to, and then it's A until I. We thought this as a guideline is assisting us, that you don't put questions that are of line ministers, but take them to the president. Because president has assigned responsibility to line ministers, that we should put question about that. We are raising an issue there that is very important, that these guidelines should be respected, which will assist us to hold the executive accountable and responsible for decisions that are taken. But we can't do that if we don't follow certain guidelines in terms of what the president is all about. And then the president is doing the work in terms of the executive and then granting honors to those that he can propose to grant honors. The issue of the responsibilities of members of the executive to the president. Also, anyway, even a dissolution of parliament and the president. Those are issues that you are putting there, that the president would be the person, when you put question to the president, question must relate to those matters that within the purview of the president, that you don't raise question about other matters that anyway the minister is responsible for them. I think those are guidelines that we are proposing for consideration acceptance by the rules committee. On guidelines on criteria for question to the deputy president, first of course we are making a point there that deputy president is allocated responsibility by president. He is there to assist the president. There are areas that are given to the president. We are making a point there that when there are new responsibilities that are given to ministers or deputy president, at least the speaker must be formally informed about that in order for her or him to know exactly who is and how is working on that. Because otherwise you can still put a question to deputy president when the president has already taken that responsibility to another person, but you still put a question without knowing that the president has changed. That whatever change of responsibilities, then the president, the office of the speaker must be informed about that officially by the leader of government business. We think that is important, can then make sure that we are informed about the changes or proposal in terms of delegation of some responsibility to member. On page 12, it says unauthorized representatives is rule 1377. On that one, really, it's just the rule is very clear, but this one is just clearing it. Our view was that there's no bigger issue here, that the parties from time to time, they say that, you know, Honorable Mtembe is not available today, Honorable Beng will pose this and do this. Generally, it does not cause any problem to any member. We think that we should then clarify, just detail some of the points. And the issue, of course, that we have agreed is 7 there, party order for question, is 134.4. We think the current practice is correct. It allows space for all members of parliament because a democratic parliament must allow all parties to participate fully. We think we should retain this one. There's no reason to change this and that. When we look at it, we think it's working. It doesn't cause any problem for anyone. We should then accept it. At 8 also, we have taken a view that we should leave the current practice of clusters for questions. I think today is economic cluster, and another day would be governance cluster. That loses it that way because it's assisting us, it's working, we shouldn't do many things on that. Of course, there's a point that we have was referred to us as a committee to look at it in terms of Rule 136.1. It's a question of the speaker dealing with the monitoring and of the answering of questions by members of the executive. We are making a point there that there are rules and 143.2, 144.5, and 146. And the point that we are proposing in terms of other issues, a long discussion on this matter, whether it is possible for us to monitor the executive. The point was taken that anyway, members of the executive, first and foremost, broadly speaking, are members of parliament. We know, of course, that the president is allowed to appoint those who are not members of parliament, that they are members of the executive. But we thought that because they account to the chamber, it is us, the parliament, that should design how do we monitor the answering of questions. But it's not really about the content or the political content. It's about when questions are posed to ministers, do ministers answer those questions, they don't answer those questions. And then we are proposing this, what we are putting forward, A to J. But the point that I want to emphasize on is that we think that there should be a subcommittee. And that is established. That subcommittee should be chaired by the chief, by the deputy speaker, preferable, or any other presiding officer designated by the speaker to work on the question of this of the monitoring of questions. And then our view is that, of course, when there are ministers who are not answering questions, because we are very serious about accountability, you know, we are not pretending on this matter. All of us are committed with accountability. We are taking a view that this committee should be almost a permanent subcommittee of the rules until, of course, again, the rules are changed in many years to come. That this committee should then assist the speaker to ensure that, because the speaker general every quarter must come to the rules committee and report, make some observation about members of the executive who don't answer questions, will have a list, because I think the office will be working on that. And then this subcommittee, then we are proposing that this subcommittee will be composed by a number of members and party representatives determined by the rules committee. This rules committee have a duty to say how big is that subcommittee. But the real proposal that you are putting forward is that this subcommittee will be chaired by the deputy speaker or other designated presiding officer, and also include in its membership the leader of governance or representative on that. Because the link between the executive and National Assembly, Parliament broadly speaking, National Assembly, is a leader of governance, of a leader of government business. At the moment, is a deputy president. We thought that this monitoring committee would make sense if we include it. It's not undermining the principle of separation of power. Anyway, it's a link already on behalf of the executive between us. And then we thought that we should put on that one. Then the speaker will receive report from a subcommittee. The subcommittee will allow members of the executive who, for the lack of a better word, who may fail to answer questions, to appear before the committee, sometimes make presentation. But making presentation is two things. A person can write an answer on paper, not really coming before the committees, because it's not a committee of inquiry or inquisition. It's just a committee that deals with the member has failed to that. The member comes in, explains himself or herself, and then in terms of presentation. And of course, presentation can't be lawyers. There will be no lawyers representing anyone. Just presentation by a member to explain really what is happening, or a written presentation, the committee look at it, the subcommittee look at it, and make some proposal, take it to the speaker. The speaker look at that one, have a discussion. If the speaker is convinced or she's convinced, then we'll take it to the rules committee, then take a final decision. We thought that process and the procedure would be very helpful for us to monitor the question. And then, of course, we are making just that when there are appropriate recommendations, the speaker then will take it to the chamber, just make an announcement there. We thought that once we start implementing this monitoring, the whole question of no answers are not there, things may change. And of course, encouraging members of the executive to account on that. This is what we are proposing. And then we didn't deal with Chapter 12 on committee system. We refer back to parties to look at it, make their presentation, look at it. But our intention is that we should finalize the guideline as soon as possible. The view that we express there, that the guidelines in terms of Chapter 12 should be submitted to the next Rules Committee meeting. And we close the chapter completely on guidelines, because it will make it easy for members of the executive, for members of parliament to start implementing them. These guidelines, again, as I've indicated, they are not there to take over from the rules. The guidelines are there to make it easy for us. In fact, in government, anyway, we pass a bill, and then once we have passed a bill, becomes an act, we have what we call regulation. Regulations to facilitation of the implementation of the bill. The guidelines in this sense, we are going to see them in that light. We think that's what, Honorable Speaker, we are proposing for the consideration by the Rules Committee. And members are here of the task team. If there are questions, they will assist us to explain some of them. But that is what we are proposing.
Thank you, Honorable Mtakane, Honorable Stian Evans, Honorable Natasha, Honorable Waters, Honorable Deputy Chief Whip, in that order.
Thank you very much. I'd just like to direct the query and questions to your submissions on Chapter 6, which is on page 4 of the document. And it's a disjuncture that we've picked up in both the sitting last week and an event in the House yesterday. So if you look at Rule 103 and 104 in the rule book, particularly 103.6, it says members' names and votes must be printed in the minutes of proceedings. And it has to happen. It's a must. It's not a may, not should. It's a must. The same is at 104.3 with manual voting. If the manual voting procedure permits, members' names and votes must be printed in the minutes of proceedings. So it brings us to the discussion that we had at Chief Whip's Forum as well this morning. And the suggestion I'd like to make is that under A1A, we insert the wording of Rule 115 that's in the rules, which reads as follows. Every member present in the chamber when the question is put with the doors barred must vote or record an abstention. Or maybe you can leave out the word doors barred. But every member present in the chamber when the question is put must vote or record an abstention. And then it's got the caveat provided in terms of Section 53.2. The presiding officer has no deliberative vote. A must cast a deciding vote with an equal number, and B may cast a deliberate vote when the question is decided with a supporting vote of at least two-thirds of the members of the assembly, and then two as well. So that'll then cover what the Chief Whip's concern was and the point he raised in the House yesterday around people present in the House are not voting. So it's the rule 115 is only applying here to divisions and the like, but for some reason not carried through in rule 103 and 4. So perhaps if we can repair that in the guidelines, it'll then provide that clarity that anybody's in the chamber at that particular time, when a vote is put, has to vote. Yea, nay, or abstain.
Honorable Mazzoni.
Thank you, Speaker. Speaker, you say it so well now. It's lovely. We spent a lot of time together in Geneva, you can tell. Chair, I just want to chat on two issues. The first one is on page 6, the guidelines for questions. And 1A and B, the editing of questions. Chair, I remain of the opinion that B is actually superfluous. And the reason for this is A says whenever questions are edited, this is done under the authority of the Speaker and in accordance with the guidelines as approved by the rules. Oh, no, sorry. It's not that B that's superfluous. It's the other one. What I wanted to say about this B is that it's very important when we read all the other objects of the questions and form of content of questions, everything has to be done with consultation. And I think that's very important. It's a very important step forward that we've taken in the rules, because nothing can be done unless the member that is submitting the question is consulted. Chair, so even something that could be viewed as problematic, which is on page 7, number E, not contain unbecoming or offensive expressions, the questions department no longer has the ultimate right to decide whether or not it's unbecoming or offensive expressions. Before anything is changed, in our case it would be Mr. Plykes, because he's the person at present, would actually contact the member and give the member an opportunity to discuss what could be perceived as unbecoming or offensive expressions. So I think that the way we've crafted it now, we've made sure that it's absolute freedom of speech for the members. And the consultative forum, we couldn't have made it more consultative if we tried. So I just wanted to point that out, Speaker, because it's important. Then also on that page, on number 7, F. Now, F is contained in the rules as present. And it says, criticizes decisions of the House of Parliament. Now, Chair, that rule is archaic. And I think that rule was specifically put in place originally, probably for the time of Verwoerd, when Helen Suzman would ask a question and Verwoerd's answer would be, your question is embarrassing the country. And her reply was, your answer, in fact, embarrasses the country. And I honestly think that, you know, when we ask questions, we certainly have the right to criticize, and a lot of criticism must be viewed as constructive criticism. Not all criticism is just for the sake of being nasty or for a form of embarrassment. A lot of criticism is levied, and it must be constructive. So I would like to say that even with that specific, you know, given the light that we took this decision to be consultative as we approach questions, F then takes away from our right to consult, and it also takes away from our right to freedom of speech. So I want us to discuss that a little bit, Speaker. Then the other one, Chair, that was worrisome, but it doesn't have to be worrisome anymore. In addition, questions may not be, and then it provides, for example, Honourable Waters just asked me, what do we define as being excessively long? Well, there isn't actually a definition for what excessively long is. But again, the member would have to be consulted. So, for example, if you send in a 10-page question, Mr. Plaatjes would have to contact you. And then you could discuss if perhaps 10 pages was a bit excessive. And also with be trivial, vague, or meaningless. What's trivial, vague, or meaningless to Mr. Plaatjes may not be trivial, vague, or meaningless to me. But the objective is Mr. Plaatjes has to consult with me before he makes any changes. And then, Chair, my last submission on this, if I may, on page 11, number 3, where it says, questions to the President may not relate to H, statements made by Cabinet ministers, and then in brackets, not deputy ministers, who are not members of the Cabinet. Chair, this was debated at length. And the reason for this is, yes, deputy ministers are not members of the Cabinet. However, they are answerable to Cabinet members who are members of the Cabinet. And if a deputy minister is making a public statement that affects the country, matters of state, or affects said minister or the president, certainly we as members of parliament must have the right to question the president, because those ministers, those deputy ministers, are accountable to their ministers who are in fact members of cabinet and to parliament. Quite right, Honourable Stenhouse.
Thank you, Honourable Waters.
Thank you, Speaker. The first point I wanted to raise is the one that Honourable Mazzotti has just referred to, and that's on page 11, 3H. I just wanted to emphasise the point. I really think we shouldn't exclude deputy ministers. I know they're not members of the cabinet, but the fact of the matter is they can make statements on behalf of the government, which influences or gives the impression that they might be doing so and influencing policy, and we should have the right to ask the President questions about that, whether that Deputy Minister had the authority to do so. Then just working backwards to the front, then on page 2, the removal of from office of the Speaker and Deputy Speaker, I see that the use of a secret ballot to remove the Speaker or Deputy Speaker is not included here. Now, I know that the answer will probably be, you know, there's a court case going on and we're going to wait for the judgment from the court case. But the fact of the matter is, Speaker, is that we don't have to wait for a court case to put the secret ballot in the rules. There's nothing preventing us from doing that. The ANC criticised the idea that we go to court and get things dictated to by court, and we should use Parliament. So, well, this time let's use Parliament and take the initiative and not be dictated to by the court, and put the right for a secret ballot in the rules for the removal of the Speaker and the Deputy Speaker. Then just on the issue of the motion of notice without motions without notice. just on the practicalities of it. I understand that if five parties say they have an objection to a motion without notice, whatever reason, that it cannot be read out. How is that going to be implemented? So, are we going to give the Speaker all the motions that have been rejected by the parties, and if someone gets up, because it's going to happen, let's face it, and starts reading one of them, the Speaker switches off the mic? Or what? I mean, how are we going to prevent it? And then, similarly, if two or three or four parties have objected to a motion, obviously they're going to get up and object under Rule 2. It may not be an individual, but it could be a party objecting to that motion of notice, obviously. I think we should expect that to happen in the House then. But that's fair enough. But I really want to get to the practicalities of how we're going to prevent motions that have been rejected by five parties from being read out in the House. Thank you.
Thanks, Honourable Speaker. On the last one that Honourable Waters was referring to, I think if five parties reject a motion, that motion should not be allowed to be read in the House, which means the table staff will have to be alerted to that matter, so the member will not be allowed to read the motion. And also, I would like to think that they will also up their games so that we get the responses and the motions on time, motions from other parties, from all the parties. Then on the issue of a secret ballot, I don't think we should go for something that is not provided for in the Constitution. There is nothing. Our Constitution is silent on this matter. Unless if we say we are going to review the Constitution, then maybe that can be provided. But as of now, there is nothing that is there. And our rules are created along the lines of the Constitution. Then the other matter is on page 11, where Comrade Tim D was saying that on the permanent subcommittee that will be dealing with the monitoring of questions, ministers should appear. I think it was a slip of the tongue. They should be invited to respond as to why they didn't respond to questions. Thanks, Honourable Speaker.
Honourable Buroto, and then Honourable Singh, followed by Honourable Mtendi.
No, thank you, Speaker. Speaker, mine is just on page 2 on the motions without notice. There's a tendency of parties, after having been granted the opportunity to raise their motions, what that was agreed to, they change the language or have additional lines. And sometimes those additional lines that they put are unparliamentary. How do we deal with that? Maybe we should, in the rules, state something concerning changing when reading as to what was accepted in writing.
Honourable Singh.
Thank you very much, Honourable Speaker, colleagues. I'll start from page 1 because I thought we'd have dealt with each page. On the motions without notice, I think we must not make things difficult for ourselves. That's why I agree with Honourable Waters that, you know, the implementation of these rules, even the five-party rule, it's going to become a bit cumbersome. And then maybe we just need to apply our minds a little on whether or not the previous system worked, you know, where the person reads it out and anyone can stand up and object. Or, you know, you look at the content in time. But we've got to make it easy for ourselves. Otherwise, we'll have this point of order on point of order and point of order like we had the other day on the secret ballot, and it delayed us by an hour, more than an hour. So, you know, that's something I think we just really need to apply our minds about. Then on the on page 3, the appointment and responsibilities of whips. the recommendation there, where the parties have six members. But I think here we've got to include the principle of rotation. And I'll tell you why, Honourable Speaker and colleagues, is that I work with the other parties at this moment in time. And some of us, on our own right and our own numbers, have whips allocated. But the other parties, well, last week I called a meeting of all of them. They complain that some of the whips that have been appointed to represent six are there permanently. They're stuck in their seats. Now, some parties with two members have got a whip, whereas a party with three members does not have a whip. Now, I'll give you an example, because Ahang, for example, the member of Ahang is a whip, official designated whip. But the other members come and complain to me that, hey, this member is not there, is not offering guidance, etc., etc. So I think we've got to call those parties together, because it's got nothing to do with me, but and see how we can devise a way of a principle of rotation every 2.5 years or something, that you have a new whip. A midterm sort of election. So I think it's important that we have some principle like that. Then on the manual voting procedure, page 5, I see in the original rules there was a caveat, and that is when the electronic system is not operational, then you'll go to manual. But here it just gives the presiding officer the right to determine whether a manual vote will take place. If you look at 104, it starts off saying where no electronic voting system is in operation, a manual system may. And then there's nothing wrong with that. But in this formulation here, it doesn't say that. It just says the presiding officer or may just determine that a manual voting may take place. So that's one point there that I'll raise. And then if I move on to page 9, C5C, questions relating to semi-state bodies. Now, are you meaning state-owned enterprises, or what are you meaning? Because is there a terminology of semi-state bodies? We'll just get our terminology right. What do we call these? I know what you're saying, but what do we call them? I haven't heard of semi-state bodies before. I've heard of state-owned enterprises. I've heard of government entities and things like that. So we must just, I just thought we should look at that. And for now, I think, Madam Speaker, those are my comments to the document by the subcommittee. Thank you.
Honourable Chief Whip.
Thank you, Chair. I think that the issue that Honourable Waters and Singh raised is something that we need to consider seriously. Indeed, if the original idea of a motion without notice was still applicable today, in fact, even the notion of five parties agreeing will not arise. It arises because that notion of a motion without notice has been thrown to the dogs. So it's something that we need to reflect on. Because indeed, what happens, Speaker, when you are presiding there, somebody shoots up, reads this motion that has been rejected. So that, again, we also try and protect through our rules those who will be presiding. Because now it becomes a problem. Should we make a problem of the House the problem of the presiding officer? I don't think that it is correct. So maybe we need to, again, think about it and think about the original idea, by the way, still stands even today. The original idea of why a motion without notice. How do we give practical meaning to that original idea? I know we're trying to do that, but we might not. Indeed, those of us who are around the room probably will still be guided by the original idea of a motion without notice. Even under these circumstances, but others will not, because that is the issue, that there are others who are not guided by this. So I think we still need further thinking and perhaps further engagement amongst ourselves as parties. so that we don't make this a problem. It will be a problem of presiding officers, unfortunately. That's the first issue. But let's thank the, because I remember at the level of the chief whips and the programming committee, we're trying to deal with the language that was in the rule book at the time. And indeed, the language has now been strengthened. But still, it does not remove the risks inherent in applying this. That's one issue, Chair, that I think we but again, wonderful work by the subcommittee. One issue, Chair, under item two, appointment and report of whips. At this point in time, again, apologies to my caucus for not having raised the matter, that it's something that we just need consideration. At the moment, we are saying the one whip for six members. And indeed, we know that this has given rise to many of committees, in fact, in the governing party not having whips, precisely because of this formula. All that I'm requesting, again, it should be helpful to other parties as well, particularly parties that have got smaller numbers. Can't we reduce this formula to 1:4 instead of 1:6? So that we are able to, it's a proposition, and we think that it's something that needs to be looked into favorably by this. Of course, everything is related to whether we have the financial means. So we must not throw the baby with the bathwater. Because indeed, if we are able to afford it, let's then implement it if we're able. It's a question of affordability, Chair. I fully concur with the Honorable Steenhuisen on us bringing Rule 115 into the equation so that when you are in the House, you are duty-bound to vote when you are in the House, either nay or yes or abstain. You can't just sit in the House and do nothing like it happened yesterday. So let's put that in the guidelines. I fully concur. I also concur with the Mason. Honorable Mason. How can you say you can't criticize decisions of either House of Parliament when we ourselves at times make stupid decisions? And as a House, why can't we criticize the decisions that we have made that sounds very, very stupid? I think it should be incumbent upon the House to reflect upon its work. And as we reflect upon our work, we might indeed come across some work that we have done that is quite shady, that we might regret why we did what we did. Now, if this rule stands, you see, we can't say that we could have handled this matter differently. If the rule stands as it stands. So I agree with broadly the sentiments that I carried in this regard. And Chair, I've requested to go and do something of international and national importance. So that we don't have difficulties this afternoon. But the letter that I've requested, that we have written, Chair, we believe that the ANC team can ably handle that letter. Thank you very much, Chair, if I might be allowed to leave.
Well, regrettably so, but we have to allow you to go and do other things that are productive for the collective. The Honorable Killian, and I saw another hand. You wanted to follow up on Honorable Ntembu. Maybe while he is walking slowly towards the door and Honorable Killian is so kind as to allow it, let me take that follow up so he can hear it.
Thank you very much, Speaker, and thank you for that. Rule 115, you know, that you must. I mean, I agree. If we are in the House, we have a responsibility. But can we get a legal opinion. You know, there are some parties, present company sort of excluded, that like going to court. So let's look at that. We don't want to have egg on our face at any time. Although I agree with the principle that if you are there, you have to take a stand. We are leaders, for better or for worse, you take a stance. Right? The other thing is on the WHIPS formula. I would be a little loath that we do that. I would rather, as smaller parties, we get more support staff if we have money. We have more support staff allocated to us rather than increase the number of WHIPs. Because we, as smaller parties, are really on the receiving end when it comes to capacity, research and other capacity. I raised this in the JSC on management of Parliament's finances. And, you know, I'm just saying again here, just as a counter. Thank you.
Honorable Steen, is it a follow-up on the matter? Okay. Honourable Killian, Honourable Waters.
Yes, Jefferson, actually I would also like to concur with what Honourable Steenhuisen has said. I was just wondering, is it necessary to include additional reference in our guidelines? If we understand, and Mr. Castle can perhaps just assist us, if we look at the electronic and the manual voting system, it is just the process followed to determine a decision of the House. Now, if a division is called, then certain procedures must follow. 112 says the doors must be barred, etc., etc. And if you don't want to vote, you must escape quickly. That's the intention. Precisely because the rules compel you to vote and that all those names must be recorded in the record of the minutes. So I think if we look at Rule 115, it clearly just reinforces that, well, it states that when the manual and electronic voting system takes place, the effect of that is it will record your vote because 115 dictates that you must vote. So I just think if we accept that our guidelines will not replace our rules, they just elaborate further, then I just want to ask, is it necessary to work on it? That's my question on that, as far as that's concerned. The second matter, Chairperson, with your permission, is the issue of the motions without notice. Now, you see, for quite long, there was an Honourable Singh and Honourable Waters and Mazzoni and those who were present in earlier parliaments would know there was no real issue because there was a good practice and an engagement between parties. The minute that one party objected, whatever, there was further engagement. What are you objecting about? Okay, there were times when, for instance, the issue of the Dalai Lama and, you know, we had those cases. But generally speaking, there was no issue. Yes, parties tried to compete to rush in to congratulate Bafana and to express dissatisfaction with the Springboks or whatever. But the point is, there was a general common understanding. And if only we could capture that intention, because ultimately we would like to have something that we have a consensus broadly. What do they say? Adequate consensus. Sufficient consensus. So the intention is to achieve that. I would submit that from the malpractice that started with the commencement of the fifth parliament, please, we should not go back there, because that's just chaos. It's really unbearable. So the intention was to try and find out how do we compile a sort of a balance to achieve what we have had. And we said, you see, if only one party can object, then it becomes a tit for tat. And therefore we said, let's make it broad enough and include the governing party and the largest opposition party, because those would be the ones that really would according to Honorable Singh as well, would have adequate staff to scrutinize the wording, etc., and to make sure that they proceed along the same lines as before. Obviously, the provision as we have it in sub Roman 2, that would still create a veto. So that could still present a tit for tat. So that is why we thought if we could move with on the lines of Roman 1, except that I don't really, the wording just reads difficult as it stands at present, but if we could move to achieve the same situation that we've had before the chaos started in the fifth parliament. So if we could find that, the Honourable Deputy Chief Whip made a suggestion here on the side and said perhaps if there's an objection from one party raised with a chair, and then the parties could talk to each other and say, listen, if you remove that word or whatever, we would go along with it. But you see, Chair, we have lost that ability to engage with each other, which is actually sad. So the intention here is just to have a sort of a mechanism. Okay, so let me leave that there. Then, Chairperson, just as far as criticism of the House is concerned, of decisions of the House, I think the intention, and we deliberated on that, and Honourable Mazzoni will probably remember, we deliberated on that and we said, what was the purpose of that? And the purpose of that is to say, once the House has taken a decision, there's a democratic expression that has taken place. Now, then you would say, Honourable Chief Whip of our party has said, yes, but, you know, maybe we've taken a silly decision. So, in some parliaments, they've introduced a period, 6 months period. So you can't criticise a decision of the House, but for the past, you know, that it has taken during the past 6 months, for instance. But thereafter, once that period has lapsed, you could then criticize it, but only with a view to moving for the decision to be rescinded. So perhaps if we take that out, we could reintroduce something to achieve a situation that you have to accept a democratic outcome of the election, but then say within a period of 6 months or a year or whatever, then... yeah, let's re-look that decision and let's reconsider it. So perhaps that is a way forward. Thank you, Chairperson.
Honourable Waters and Honourable Sienese.
Thank you, Speaker. If I can start on the point that Honourable Killian left off on. I think the fact that we are preventing members criticising the decision of Parliament curtails freedom of speech, which isn't enshrined in the Constitution, and more so, members of Parliament are supposed to be able to, you know, more latitude and freedom of speech than in the House than outside the House. And what we are doing is stifling opinion and thought. And it doesn't mean, you know, just because the House has done something that the majority, in fact, it's hardly ever happens these days, where every single party supports something, particularly when it's a contentious issue. And you should be able to express yourself, quite frankly. And while one does respect the outcome, the majority outcome, doesn't mean you're trying to undermine the process. The fact is you're allowed to criticize the decision that was made. Do you give what I'm saying? I hope you do. Anyway, so I honestly think it's an archaic rule, and I think Honourable Mazzoli hit the nail on the head. It was probably introduced by the Nats in the apartheid era so that people like Helen Suzman and others could not criticize their decisions. I honestly think that's where it emanates from. But anyway, so that's something we need to look at. On the issue of the motions without notice, I concur here with the freedom of speech. I concur with the Honourable Killian. The fact that gentlemen and ladies agreement that we had amongst the parties is gone. And it is being abused. It's been used as a member statement for very political issues and quite sometimes insulting. Mm-hmm. And so that's my fear, that when you're in the chair speaker or any of the other presiding officers, how do we ensure that you're also protected? Because it's going to erupt into chaos once more. We know that. So if there isn't a sort of a strict mechanism where we can ensure that a motion without notice that doesn't adhere to the rules, because it probably wouldn't have even submits half their motions without notice in the first place, let's face it, or has been rejected by five parties, is not allowed to be read out. And I don't know how we get around that, honestly. And it's unfortunate because we do want to congratulate or commiserate with people on certain occasions. So I think we need to apply our minds there. I know I'm not coming up with a solution, but I think we need to start applying our minds. Then on, just the last year, on the secret ballot speaker. While I understand the Constitution is silent on the matter, the Constitution is an overarching piece of legislation that gives general principles to how we as a country should make laws and how we treat individuals, for example. The fact of the matter is the Constitution doesn't say you may not have a secret ballot. It doesn't rule it out. It's silent on the matter. Nor does it say you must have a secret ballot to remove the speaker or the deputy speaker. But it doesn't say you mustn't either. So the fact is that discretion is left up to Parliament. And that's why I'm saying, for me, the principle here is that if you have a secret ballot to elect someone, you should have a secret ballot to remove someone, irrespective of who that individual is. And that's my view. So thank you.
Yeah, I heard what the Honourable Killian had to say around the issue about the superfluous of adding the words of 115, but I think she would know that electronic voting is not only used for divisions. The number of times where it's used for a quorum check, it's used when we have constitutional office majorities that are required in the House, like yesterday. So, unfortunately the rules at the moment only have it in 115, they don't have it in the other, which is why I feel it should be introduced in the guidelines. So just in terms of the secret ballot, I think that the Pluama case was clear. The court didn't rule against secret ballots, but said that they themselves were not going to interfere in Parliament's rights to determine its own internal procedures. So, I mean, perhaps we need to schedule a discussion at some stage on secret ballots and how we have them, and if they are required in laws. But I think that the Pluama judgment said is that it's up to Parliament to determine its own internal procedures, and the court was reluctant to interfere and direct Parliament on how, when, and why it should do a particular matter unnecessarily, and that was out of respect for the separation of powers. So, I mean, just because that we have the Pluama judgment, it's not in itself precluding a discussion in this House at some stage around secret ballots, whether they're required or not.
Honourable Deputy Chief Whip and Honourable Mtakane.
Thanks, Chairperson. Honourable Speaker, when we deal with the reviewal of rules, we compare them with other parliaments or legislatures within our country. Then on the issue of the reflection upon a decision, We checked the Western Cape legislation. They have a rule here that reads as follows. No member may reflect upon any decision of the House taken less than 6 months previously, except for the purpose of moving that decision be amended or rescinded. So I think if this is used in the Western Cape, there is nothing wrong with us, with the proposal that Comrade Killian was making.
No, I do accept, Honourable Speaker, that the motion without notice is the most difficult one. Precisely because it's not our creation. We are responding to the challenges that we are facing. To find a better way of working it in whatever way, let us try to do so. But it's the most difficult thing. Because if you deny ourselves right to congratulate imminent persons because one party has simply filibustered the entire parliamentary procedure, I think we would have submitted ourselves to a wrong way of doing things. The, what we are proposing is not a perfect situation. I take the point that how do we do that? The point is that before anyone read any motion without notice, surely the presiding officer will have a list of motions that have been approved. And because otherwise you wouldn't know which one is approved, which one was rejected. We'll have a list of them, and therefore we'll be able to preside over and say, Honorable C, because your motion without notice has been approved. We thought that that's how we can manage it for time being. And then because if we don't do that, the first feeling, and I think the first reaction for us is get rid of this completely. Why should we waste day and night thinking about the motion without notice? Because anyway, members are allowed to have motion without notice. But I think it was brought to our attention of that, but we'll be denying members a right to sometimes commend the members of eminent persons in our country or good things that are happening in our country. Like Bafana Bafana won against Senegal. We may want, one member may want to move that one. The feeling that what do we do in a situation where one party simply undermined the entire practices of parliament? Do you simply then cut? Because if we cut one rule to accommodate them, they will cut all the rules. Because they've taken a view that no mercy for anything, no practices, no convention, no rules. What do we do then? Then our view was that the best thing to do is to try to meander this the way we are proposing. How you do that, our view was that, of course, parties will receive it. I take the point that is raised by Honorable C. Parties will get it, say, no, you object on this, is recorded. The person in offices of the speaker who's working on this matter. Then once, of course, we have agreed them, the list will be written there. That is motion 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. And then the speaker or the presiding officer will have this motion. Then we'll call according to what has been agreed. And therefore, if another member comes out without being called on the list of motion or viewers, that member first will be out of order because the motion would have been rejected. Is it securing us for a long term? I don't know. It's something that we are trying to do. But the best thing really that we thought we should do, cut it off. But we thought also cutting it off really is also not a very democratic way of doing it. Because if we do that once, we have to change all the rules to accommodate one party. 12 other parties agree, and then one party says you don't. And then if you allow and succumb to that, we thought that we can make a serious democratic mistake. That's the point that we're making, that whatever way it can work, we thought that 5 parties is a little bit sufficient for us to start dealing with this matter. And then we thought that we should do that. The governing party, official opposition, or the largest minority, as it's written, we think this three parties can do so. But doesn't stop, of course, political leadership to engage outside the rules, in general, persuading each other to do this thing. Whether the party is going to agree or not is a separate issue. But I do think that, Honorable Waters, maybe the best thing was to get rid of it. But if you get rid of it, our view is that, of course, you're undermining the democratic processes. Some members genuinely, they raise matters that are very important for all of us. They pick it up, they raise it in the chamber. What is allowed, anyway? That's why the motion not noticed. That when you go to the chamber, something big happens. And then you can't wait for a member to propose a motion with notice, take procedure. A member is going to stand up there, and the Honorable Singh, and there is one, the Nobel Peace Prize, and then a member just hearing as he go to the chamber. The member should be allowed to do so. That's what really we thought we should be trying to accommodate. It's a difficult procedure and processes, but we think let us allow it to work the way it is proposed. And if it doesn't work, it can be reviewed one way or another. And then, again, the best thing to be defeated, get rid of it, close it. And if you get rid of it, you must get rid of point of order, all other rules, that the one party is opposed to all of them. I think then we'll have a bigger problem, how you run the affairs of legislation. I thought a criticism, I thought the point that is read that decisions of the assembly, firstly, they are taken by a majority. But also, this rule was meant really, I'm not sure about the apartheid one. I know that other parliament in Kenya, Uganda, and other areas, I'm not sure that also they are democratic or not, but as far as I know, they are democratic parliament. Is the point that once the majority have taken a decision, and it's a decision of majority, all members participated on that decision, it can't generally be criticized. And then in a manner that destroys the credibility and integrity of parliament or decorum of parliament, I think it's meant for that. I don't think it was meant to cover up, that parliament simply cover up for things that are wrong. It was meant to protect the decorum of parliament, decorum of presiding officers and head of institution. Of course, if a member wants to make a decision, surely, their motion, what we call substantive motion. Their substantive motion, a member can come there with a substantive motion, say that there's this thing that has happened somewhere. Can we discuss it on that? But the point really is protection of all of us as members, because we'll discuss, I'm sure, many decisions that sometimes don't agree with it, but the majority has taken a view on that. I think in my view, Honorable Speaker, maybe we shouldn't try to resolve it. It's one of the issues that maybe should be allowed sometime, like a secret ballot, for us to have a discussion. Because if we have a discussion on it outside this meeting for today, it can assist us sometimes. If it is wrong completely, if it is in the guidelines can simply change any day on that. And I think I agree with the question that is put by Honorable Honorable Steenhuisen, that we should put 115. I think we should put it in the guideline. I don't think it's causing any harm for us to do so. And then other areas, Honorable Speaker, that I thought there are no difficult issues for us really to move for the adoption of the guidelines, with the right, of course, that we are going to discuss the motion of the vote ballot, secret ballot, and also we discuss this criticism of decision of parliament. Because in India, I think, is the biggest democratic country in the world. They do have that. The purpose there was not apartheid purpose. The purpose was that you can't also allow a systematic undermining of a democratic decision of majority at a time. That's what they were saying. And then we thought that is an issue that is very important. But let us look at it in terms of our own understanding of South Africa, maybe without removing it for the guidelines. It's not a rule, it's just a guideline. Let us then work it out in the next meeting when we meet, sometimes have some time to do so. I don't think it would kill us to allow some time for us to have a proper discussion on it.
Mr. Council.
Thank you, Madam. I wanted to add that when we look at that point about criticism, the committee would also want to look at Rule 87, which says no member may reflect in a disrespectful manner upon the House, or its forums and committees, or upon their proceedings and decisions. So maybe you should look at it in those broad terms. in terms of motions without notice, what we have been doing, at least up to the time they were suspended, is that parties would submit to the table before 11 o'clock. We would vet those motions against the rules, and our vetting is limited to procedural vetting. We don't vet political elements. So a motion could qualify procedurally, but politically there could still be issues where a certain party is accused of doing certain things. We would not get involved in that space. We would only circulate those motions that comply with the rules to the rest of the parties. And of course, it has happened that between 11 and 2 o'clock, a motion changes. So what then gets read out in the House will be different from what was submitted and edited. So those are some of the dynamics that we experience at the moment.
Honourable members, we still have three items, 6, 7, and 8. But I think coming out of this earlier rather long discussion, I hear us speaking nostalgically about a time when we were able to come into the House, know that there is a space for notices of motion, get in there, express them, and move forward. And in our nostalgic way of reflecting and referring to that time, we are sounding rather helpless, and that's what I'm confused by. What makes honourable members helpless in this matter? Do we not have the right to say, actually, as South Africans, as representatives of our people, we are here and we insist on our right to have issues that we agree on that are non-controversial, around which we do have sufficient consensus, and we think it is a healthy thing for South Africa for us to retain that space on which we must, as South Africans, on whom the rest of the country looks upon, to just give a sense of agreement on something. It's the best thing we can do for our country. And in my view, for us to sound like, oh, there was that time, now we've lost that innocence, why don't we bring it back? It's in our hands, in my view. And just say, yes, we have time, we always have the space to express difference, which we seem to prefer more than expressing agreement. However, this, we believe, must remain the space for those things on which we agree, so that we always give that hope to our people that there are things on which even our children must be taught we must agree. I once attended a workshop where some people who work in the peacekeeping division of the United Nations were sharing with us part of what they are confronted with as they move around and they do their work. And they had even come to a point where they decided that it's in the good, it would stand humanity in good stead to teach children that each time you disagree on something, children playing outside, you don't have to fight about it. Fighting about it is not what must come to mind immediately. It's not necessarily the best way of dealing with challenges or maybe confrontations that life throws at us. That there are times when you must deliberately apply different methods of arriving at what's best for the two children that are playing, or those children that are playing. If we are now conveying to our people that, no, in fact, the only way to engage with one another is disagreement, is negativity, is being adversarial, it's confrontation. That's why you have ISIS and those situations out there. And in my view, one of the things we are charged with the responsibility to apply our minds on is what this means to us. What is it challenging us to do? And in my view, we can't just help it and say we've lost our innocence. The fifth parliament came upon us. We now always fight about everything. There's nothing we ever agree on. I don't agree, honorable members. If I may, for myself, express this difference of how we approach this thing. Honorable members, let us try and see how far we can go with the agenda, because it's already 1 o'clock. In fact, past one.
I just would like to confirm the decision on this matter on the guidelines. Are the guidelines being adopted with the adjustments? The issue of criticism of houses, we remove at this point, or we keep it in the guidelines?
I thought the feeling was that there's no harm to keep it in the guidelines, but we'll have time to discuss it. Once we have a time discussion, reflect, we can then remove it if we agree to do so.
Motions without notice, what are you saying about this matter of loss of innocence? Yes. Honourable members, what are you saying?
Honourable Speaker, my understanding is that honourable members have commented on it, but it seems you are not really surrendering. We are saying that what the task team is proposing, let's try to implement it, that we get better in understanding. Because I think parties, as we go on, as the point that you are raising, Honourable Speaker, the point that I think we should try to do is just the parties that agree, they must agree and do things. I think in my view is that we accept the proposal and therefore we try to implement it. The point that was raised, how do we do that? I think already the team in the office is a practical issue. Already they've designed the system. I think we are accepting, honestly. We'll change it once we are normal again.
Mm-hmm. That's issue, ma'am. The standing order on motions without notice would require House decision, that one. So you can either go tomorrow to the House or Tuesday next week. And then politically a decision could be taken as to whether it must be applied this year still or from next year. That's one. The guidelines do not require House decision. So it will also be published in the ATC.
Okay. The letter of the Chief Whip of the Majority Party. The matter that is contained in principle in this letter also arises in the guidelines we've just discussed. Because if we look at, where is it? Report of the in terms of questions. If you look at page 7, where it says general form and content of questions, there's E there that talks about that the question must not contain unbecoming or offensive expression. A question is not permissible which contains offensive expression. But I think, of course, in the application, we would also refer to just that which members say in the chamber as they are expressing themselves, that what's being raised is that the tone of how the exchange proceeds and the kind of language that is used in the House in that exercise should not be offensive in the sense as described here in these guidelines. Just to make reference to that. But honorable members, I'm introducing the subject. Is there anything else you want to say, honorable Stianese?
Thanks very much, Madam Speaker. I think that it actually goes further than that. I think our rules already deal with the situation. I don't think we need to apply our minds anymore. We have Rule 84 and Rule 85, which very clearly deal with these matters. It's up to the presiding officers to implement the rules. Suffice it to say that I think that we also need to understand that politics by its nature is a robust, it's a robust business. It's not like sitting in a boardroom at Anglo American or Pick and Pay. It is a political environment, and you know, events generally do get heated and that. So I don't think we must, confuse robustness with disrespectfulness or what are the words that are used here? Tone, etc., etc. And so members of the House are entitled to, and that's why we have parliamentary privilege, that we can say things that need to be said, and that we can, it's the one place in the country where we can actually have a frank, open and honest discussion with each other in a way that you know, that promotes public debate. But that being said, I think that there's been several rulings already on what is acceptable and what's not acceptable. And I think it's up to the presiding officers to, you know, obviously flesh out these rulings if necessary, and for parties who feel aggrieved by them to use whatever recourse they have to challenge them. But I mean, I certainly don't think we need to be developing new rules or anything. I think that Rules 84 and 85 deal sufficiently with this. But if what the spirit of the letter is that when the president arrives in the House, we must all say yes, sir, no, sir, three bags full, sir, that ain't going to happen. I'm not going to do it. But I certainly will keep my comments and my discussion within the bounds of the rules of Parliament.
Honourable Didiza, Honourable Deputy Chief Whip, Honourable Mtakane, Honourable Singh.
Thank you very much, Speaker, and my apologies for having come late. Unfortunately, my meeting ran over that I had earlier. Just to say, I agree with you that indeed, and also the other honourable members, Stanis, and have said that it. I think the issues that we're trying to deal with, as raised by the Chief Whip in his letter, are covered by the rules, are also, you know, elaborated further on the guidelines. It's maybe more on the application when such happens and how we deal with it, as you have already explained, Speaker. But I just wanted to to say probably one of the things we might not deal with it in any rule or guideline form, but at some stage, as members, is an appreciation that what probably we need to inculcate among ourselves is the values of Ubuntu that are enshrined in our preamble of the Constitution. It's not about whether we cannot differ. We can, because the standpoints from which we move are not the same. But there is humanness in all of us. We can't demean each other. And I think at times we lose that in terms of our values and how we then engage in the discourse, that we then end up losing that respect of that value of human dignity which is enshrined in our Constitution. And I may not have an answer now, but I think it's something that we really have to remember in terms of our Constitution, what we were trying to say. We could have left it with, you know, principles of equality and egalitarian on one hand and liberty, but I think those who drafted our Constitution by inserting that value of human dignity did so having recalled where we come from as a country and how we were seeking to build this new nation of accommodating each other's different but within that element of humanity. And I think this is, in my view, Chairperson, we lose at some stage in that debate because we can still argue but in a very respectful way. We can still be robust in a respectful way that doesn't demean on others. Because as we exercise our rights, I think for me what is important is to also appreciate the right of the other. because my right can't be superior than the right of another person. And it is that issue which I think is something that we need to continuously remind one another of. And at some stage it plays itself in the manner in which we behave outside the house. I actually, last week, noticed, and I was saying to myself, I wonder whether members noted, as we were finishing the vote on the vote of no confidence, Honorable John Favs fell ill. And the first people who jumped to assist were the two honorable member doctors of the DA. In that moment, that human value of human dignity emerged. It wasn't like we've just defeated one another in that motion and therefore it doesn't matter. So I'm just saying that for me, I think that's the crux of the matter. No matter how we differ, but I think it's being able to respect that humanity among us.
Thanks, Honorable Speaker. I agree with Honorable Didiza on what she was saying. You know, as the ANC, when the president comes to the house, we understand that he is there to respond to questions. We are not saying that members shouldn't criticize, but they must do so in a more dignified way, because we are honorable members of parliament. Irrespective of views that we might have about each other. So it's very painful when you see honorable members resorting to insults instead of them criticizing in a more dignified way. So it doesn't sit well with us. Yes, we can't do the same because we are the disciplined cadres of our movement. So we can't resort to insults. Our approach is always to respect other members of parliament. So we request the same. We are asking for the same treatment. Because if these things of him coming to the house, wasting time, insulting him all the time, if it continues, Honorable Speaker, we don't see a need for him to come to the house. We want him to come to the house to respond to questions, not to be insulted. If we have issues around him, about him, then I think we should use other channels to deal with those issues, not to do it in the house, not to insult each other. We are role models of other people. What is it that the younger generation is learning from us if we don't respect each other? So that is our issue, Honorable Speaker, that we are trying our level best to make sure that our members behave in a manner that is acceptable, not insult other members. Whenever there is criticism about any member, they must do so with dignity. So if these things continue, Honorable Speaker, I don't think that is acceptable, and it reflects bad on all of us as members of parliament. Thank you.
Honorable Dakane, Honorable Singh, Honorable Waters.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. I think the problem that we always have is that we are discussing amongst us who are disciplined. The people who are causing problems are not even in this meeting. And then on the 23rd, they will do exactly what you are talking about. Because ourselves, with Honorable Steenhuisen, Honorable Singh, we can define the chamber, but I know very well that when we are outside the chamber, we talk. We are friends, in fact, outside the chamber. And then, but the party that is going to do that again is not here. I agree with Honorable Steenhuisen that we should really try to protect the integrity of the president too. We do have a responsibility as members of parliament. We may not like him as individuals, but we can't afford a situation where insults are held at the president. In fact, I think he raised it in the last meeting, Honorable Speaker, that if you don't want me to come here, tell me I won't come here. And I think we shouldn't put him in a situation like that, because I think he's very happy to come and account to the two members of parliament. But to treat him the manner in which we've been treating him, I don't think is correct. But the problem that all of us who are here, we don't do that. Those who are not here that are doing it. Then that's a bigger problem that we have. I think also they forgotten this meeting consciously anyway. And then in preparation for, I think they see the letter already, they didn't want to come and discuss the very same issue that we are raising. I think we should apply the rules. And then also we allow Jenara to evict members from the chamber. I think Natasha would agree with this one. When really a person doesn't want to agree on the decision by the speaker or pronouncement by the speaker, I think we should use the rule of taking people outside. The protection services are there. Because I think the manner in which they do it, I have no problem for members when the president comes in, those some stand, sit down. Those are polecat decisions to make. But to shout at him, call him a thief, call him all these things, there's no decency in doing that. I don't think we want our politics to be so uncivilized in a manner that causes so harm for all of us on that. But a bigger problem, Comrade Speaker, that I think the leadership of the institution should discuss with all other parties is just to agree what are our national interests in general. Because I do think that one of the problems that we have not really defined what is our national interest. What is it that we agreed on? Because sometimes it's very easy selectively to use the gloriness of the Constitution, but also undermining the Constitution at the same time. I think it's a big issue on that. I do think that the Whip Party, they should meet also, even before the 23, and have a podcast discussion about how do we conduct ourselves in the chamber. And I think they do attend Whip Party meeting, Honorable Waters. I think we can persuade them, anyway, to agree with us that we should act, because what happened if you go to the chamber, the president got insulted, he takes his jacket and leaves. What do we do? He's there to answer questions. 1 hour is wasted because of point of order, disrespect. I don't think that is what we want, particularly many of us who are here. My view, Honorable Speaker, is that the Whip Party must work it out, but also those who are involved in the political management of the institution, they must work it out, Honorable Singh. You have to have a situation where these ones who are doing all this, they understand that we are no longer really very appreciative of what they are doing. Because keep on following them. When they ejected out of the chamber and Honorable Waters moved with them, I think in their mind anyway is that they are supported broadly, when they're not supported by anyone. And in my view, that we should try to isolate bad behavior and ensure that we put the president. I think the ANC, as we said also yesterday in our debate, we want to deepen democracy, and we are serious about that. We are serious about accountability and responsiveness of the executive, the president, even the president. In fact, we have increased even time to show that we are not really there to protect anyone. But I don't think it's correct to call him the names that Comrade have been doing. But we are from the EFF. And I think we should find a way of doing that. My view, we must apply the rule of the 21st very harshly. If we have to take members out to continue to undermine the speaker, we must do so. And then if there are sympathizers or solidarizers, I think we'll accept the point to discuss this matter. I think in my view, that's what we should do, Honorable Waters, because I think we wouldn't like it anyway. Let us go to Johannesburg. We end up with the other parties there insulting Mashaba. We call Mashaba to come and account. We simply stand up there. We call him all other things. I don't think it would be correct for you as a party. Because it's not just about, anyway, the president. It's about us as a nation. Firstly, Comrade Speaker, we are told that anyway, your parliament, our parliament, is broadcast throughout the continent. And then we start a president, the next day must go to Kenya to meet with his colleagues, the next day must go to New York, and then it just got correct for us, really. In my view, Honorable Speaker, initially, I think I'm persuaded now to restrict my view, was that the president should not come to the chamber. And then, no, I take that as an obligation, but he can't come, because he comes to the Shema to account, not to be insulted, but because of the discussion, no, because of the discussion that is here now, I'm persuaded that applying the rules strictly on the 23rd, and politically start engaging with other people, Honorable Kubisa can also engage other people as in the Whip Party, have a discussion on that and agree on it. In fact, that was my strong feeling that if President got insulted, must leave the chamber, goes. And then the members will see then what they want to do. But I think the one that we say we should apply our rules strictly, I really support. But also talking to members every time it is correct, because we must not surrender Parliament to a situation where everyone then doesn't respect the rules of the chamber, because otherwise there will be no engagement on that. I think I support the rules, let us apply it and work it out on that. And I think the ANC in our view can support that type of approach, Honorable Speaker, and defend the presiding officers, and then whenever we do this. I think now the rules are there. I think they're very strict. We should apply them completely. But one way or another, I think Honorable Waters, you can also talk to Shibambo. We are almost part of a bigger four. We can persuade your colleagues also not to do what they're doing in the chamber. I think we can succeed to do so. We are going to engage them. Everyone should engage them and persuade them to ensure that they work according to the rules of the chamber. That's what Comrade Speaker. I'm persuaded now, really. I was very strong that the President don't come here, because you can't come here to be insulted this way.
Thank you, Honorable Speaker. Let me just indicate that I have to leave at 1:45 for the meeting with international relations at 2:00. So please, I'll leave in 5 minutes as I walk outside. Thank you. But Honorable Speaker, let me say, you know, what happens outside of the House in many instances is a manifestation of what happens inside. When we had the motion of no confidence, I have no doubt in my mind that the scuffle upstairs was as a result of what happened downstairs and the way we were conducting ourselves that led to that scuffle upstairs. I don't know what happened upstairs. Who was called in, would not, but it would seem police and security and everybody else were called in there. So I'm just saying, I agree that, you know, what we do is a reflection on what happens outside, what people do outside. But having said that, Chairperson, I think the operative words in the letter is how we apply the rules. And I don't think we should be talking about how we apply the rules when the President is there, when the Deputy President is there, or anybody else is there. All of us should get equal application of the rules in the way the presiding officers use it. I mean, during the motion of no confidence, it was very disturbing to note that when the leader of the opposition was speaking, the noise levels from the majority party members behind me there was just totally unacceptable, you know. And then I said over there, what you are hearing now, you're going to hear it when a member of the ruling party speaks, and that's exactly what happened. So I think the presiding officers have to be really, and I'm glad most of them are here, have got to be really more careful in their application and understanding of the rules. I mean, we have a general agreement in the House. If you want to raise a point of order, pick your hand up. I know Honorable Speaker is very particular about that. Don't just stand up and then you get... I mean, there were at least 10 or 15 members before me or before my leader that just sprung up and they were being recognized by the presiding officer on points of orders. Now, you sit there like a little child, you want to behave according to the rules, and then this is what happens. So I'm saying the presiding officers as well, Honorable Speaker, have to be very, very measured in the way they deal, apply the rules. If you look at points of order, I mean, the rules state quite clearly, if the presiding officer makes a ruling on a point of order, that's it. You can, there's a mechanism to appeal. It's provided for in the rules. Use that. But if I make a ruling, that's it. And I'll say to you, Honorable Member, I've made a ruling, full stop, thank you. You want to contest it, here's the rule, so and so. Go and apply, use that particular rule. Similarly, you know, the Rule 70, ordering a person to leave. If a person continuously defies the presiding officer, in the recent past, and I'm saying this, I'm saying this without wanting to insult anybody, I find that some of the presiding officers are taking a softer stance in terms of application of the rules than they should. Because if I say some of those things in the House, I should be treated in the same way as anybody else, whether I'm ordered to leave, whether I'm named, or etc., etc. So I think, Madam Speaker, this is not only about the President, but it's about all of us, the decorum of the House, and proper application of the rules from the side of the presiding officers. Because many times, that becomes the debate, that the presiding officer has chided A, B, or C, and not D, E, and F, and allows things to happen. So that's my point, but I think it's going to take a meeting of minds. Rules are not going to ensure that we behave properly, but it's going to take a meeting of minds somewhere in the near future for us to really deal with this matter. Thank you.
Thank you, Speaker. I'll try and be brief. I've also got a meeting at 2, so I'll have to excuse myself. But just on the... I promise you I'll be... Speaker, on the issue or the principle of Ubuntu, I agree. We should all help. Whenever, it doesn't matter which party you're from, if someone is in need, you help each other. All right. And so I think we all agree on that one. And I'm very proud of our members that helped Honourable Fubbs last week. But that is outside the arena of Parliament. Parliament is a unique body. It's like a stage, right? A performance, if I can put it that way. And we all are there, and we all do perform. Now, I concur with all the members that the rules have to be implemented fairly, but not just for the sessions where the presidency or the deputy president, for every single session, because that was one of the criticisms at the beginning of this term. And even the deputy president raised that in that document that he signed with all the leaders, was the fact that rules aren't being enforced fairly in the House. And I think we really need to stress that. It has to happen. I agree. Look, Parliament is a robust environment, and we shouldn't curtail freedom of speech, right? I mean, it is. It's a lot rougher than most arenas or workplaces. And last week, our leader was insulted during the debate, and the individual wasn't asked, the member wasn't asked to retract that, despite a point of order. So it comes from both sides. And as I say, if the rules are applied equally, I think it will go a long way. Having said that, the President is quite unique in a lot of ways. First of all, he does have an obligation to come to Parliament, and he cannot back out on that and renege on his constitutional obligations. He has to come. But he's also... in a lot of ways his own worst enemy because of all the controversy around him. And he does stir up emotions when he comes into the chamber. He does, because of what... There's so many controversial issues around the President that you've got to expect to face the music when he does come to Parliament. You got to. Now, I'm not saying people must be insulting and, get up and, swear at him or things like that. But the fact of the matter is he's got to have a thicker skin and he's got to take it on the chin, quite frankly. I've been here 17 years, believe it or not. I can't believe it, actually. I was speaking to someone about it the other day. And when I first got here and President Mbeki got up to speak, the House was silent. You could hear a pin drop. And that was because of the respect people had for the person that was the President of South Africa. Unfortunately, that no longer exists for various reasons. And I think as the ANC, you also need to reflect on that and understand where the opposition is coming from. But as our Chief Whip has said, from our side, we do stick to the rules. I think you agree with that as much as possible. We don't... try and insult people, and when our members do that, we ask them to withdraw. We do. And I think if we can get that cooperation from all parties, it'll be a better place, Parliament. But having said that, the party concerned is not here again. So I don't know how we address it with them as well. Thank you.
Now, I won't be long, Honourable Speaker. I think in majority members of Parliament have expressed their point of view and quite supportive that we should be able, all of us, to put an effort together. Because the process where we are and the process that we were before was that there was a lot of engagement between members of Parliament and talking to each other to understand and explaining to each other the type of environment we had. But here what we are saying that, you see, we should always be cautious that we're dealing with the state president and the legacy we set for ourselves here can be very problematic into how society defines us over some time. Because if this behavior is what Honorable Singh is saying, continues, it becomes a point of concern even in society, how they reflect upon members that they send to Parliament. All we are saying is African National Congress that let's all put heads together and let's make sure that the presiding officers implement the rules with no blink of an eye. When somebody, but this is a detail that we've even been able to deal, that if you speak, we should even press the mic off so that you don't continue talking there. So we've done everything possible. But the point that we are at, the president respects the constitution, he supports it, he does everything to make sure that he comes and answers the questions. But we are getting wary as the African National Congress in how that relationship is being interpreted, where he gets undermined and demeaned, and even demeaned the office that he represents. And even the presiding officers, the type of treatment they get. All we are saying that there should be some understanding from broadly members of Parliament that whatever reaction comes after that, or when the rule 8485 gets implemented, it's not done because we have not done our best in the fifth term to be able to persuade everybody to be on board and give and accommodate everybody to be able to understand the rule. But time is against us, where whatever we have put together as an effort is daily getting undermined, and people are getting wary about the type of parliament and representatives that we have in parliament. And the constitution is going to get undermined, because when the president doesn't come, we're conscious that it doesn't benefit any one of us. But we have to put our foot down now. That's what we're saying, Madam Speaker.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, I think it is encouraging to hear what the members have been saying. The most important thing is, as members have indicated, is the rules, in particular Chapter 5, which gives specific rules in the hands of the presiding officers. And I think they must just apply them very, very meticulously. And obviously, as some of the members have indicated, that they feel that sometimes it is done in a partisan manner, and obviously that also undermines the decorum in the House. However, I would just like to make a special appeal, and I'm actually sorry that Honourable Singh has moved, not that he represents the party that is mostly guilty of the sort of misconduct that we see in the House, but I think all of us must differentiate between the office and the current incumbent of an office, because what we should be thinking about is the type of democracy that we are developing and the type of democratic institutions that we are developing. Are we engaging with each other in debate, or are we in a mudslinging match? And that reflects in society as well, Chairperson. And there are many, many authors political scientists that actually expressed a serious concern about the fact that we've lost the ability to communicate with each other. And that today, by the way, is the day of International Day for Tolerance or whatever. And I think it's appropriate that we discuss this matter today. We should listen to each other more often and not get involved in the mudslinging match. So the request to the presiding officers should be, please apply the rules. And make sure, because
Yes, it's true. Honourable Mazzoni referred to the noises during the motion of no confidence from the majority party benches. But can I also just say the largest opposition party is also not innocent, and they are very often very guilty of conversing aloud. And to the extent that it's very difficult for people speaking from the podium to concentrate on what they have, to, the message. So I don't think there are any angels in the house. Let's accept it. Let's all accept that we have to do introspection and see how we can restore the dignity, not for any political party, but for future generations, that we build institutions that can withstand the test of time. Just remember one thing. Any party who is misbehaving in the current dispensation and who may in future become a governing party will find it just about impossible to reverse wrong trends. We're also setting bad examples for students, for universities, for other local councils, etc. So let's just, we can debate and differ absolutely 100% on matters, but let's retain the dignity of the institution and the office, be it the executive office and the office of parliament. Thank you, Chair.
Yeah, thank you very much. I think that that we all accept that parliament can only operate if we have rules and that those rules are then applied. It's the same for everything else in life, whether it's a sports tournament or anything. There are rules and parameters that set out how we operate. We try as far as possible, and I'm not saying we're perfect, and I'm certainly not holding that out as a proposition, Honourable Killian, that we are perfect. We also get it wrong sometimes. But I think that what we have with the rules and with the presiding of the House is a credibility deficit. And we're only going to build that credibility if the rules are applied and seem to be applied to everybody equally. So, for instance, last week, the Leader of the Opposition, who's also a constitutional office bearer, if you look at the Constitution, just like the President, was called a blackface in the House. Every time he stands up to speak, there's a small group of the ANC members at the back corner, at the left door, who shout, sell out, sell out, sell out, sell out, the whole way during his speech. One of our members has been called the K-word in this house. It's never been dealt with. I lodged a complaint to the Ethics Committee. The Ethics Committee wrote back to me say that your office was dealing with it and they're not acting on it until your office had come back to them. In the motion of no confidence last week, Mr. Self was loudly booed for at least a minute at the end of his talk while the Deputy Speaker was engaged in sharing notes with Honourable Pandor and did nothing about it. So, and I think that we have frivolous points of order that are raised continuously by members who stand up and raise simply to disrupt other people from speaking. And that's also people from the ruling party as well who do that, not only the EFF, not only us. So, you know, I think that if one looks at other parliaments around the world, I mean, we have a robust environment. If you watch the weekly Prime Minister's questions in the House of Westminster, it is a robust engagement. There is, you know, a lot of heckling and jostling from the benches, but where I think the differentiation is, there's no personal mudslinging that takes place. So it's a robust political environment. The Prime Minister shouldn't feel comfortable in the House when he comes to, no member of the executive should feel comfortable in the House when they come to Parliament. They should feel on edge that they need to account, they need to be on top of their game. That's part of the reason why we have executive accountability and why Parliament is the mechanism to do so. But it must be done in a robust and respectful manner. But I think the point I want to leave us with is that we will have credibility with the rules when they are applied equally to everybody. And rulings are made, whether it's the Leader of the Opposition who's insulted in a personal manner on the basis of his race, whether it's a President who's prevented from speaking. Honourable Ndokone, we want the President to account. It's a great opportunity for us in the House to hold him accountable and fulfil the mandate that we've been given. On every single occasion, you recall I've risen to say we must proceed with the business of the House. We want questions to the President. We want him to answer the questions. So, you know, I think the problem again is that much like Chief Whip's forum this morning, we're preaching to the choir. The people in this room are generally the people that are on board already. So I don't know how we're going to engage with the parties that are not here, but it's obviously a As Douglas Gibson used to say, you've got to work with the tools God's given us, and that's what we've got.
Okay, honourable members, I think we've had a frank discussion on these matters. Honourable Kubisa, you want to?
Yes, Honourable Speaker, I wanted to say, I think the meeting that usually convene with the leaders of parties, and I'll say let it be extended a bit, and not only the leaders of parties be invited, but also some whips at some point, so that the message is cascaded down to the members. I think that forum does help the meeting that is convened by yourself as the speaker and also the chair of the NSOP. It can help us to an extent to say these are the leaders and also these are the whips to cascade the message. Because what is happening really doesn't bode well for our democracy. There could be things that we don't agree on, but the state, the president is the head of state. I believe that he should be accorded that image and that stature when he comes to the House. And what we do in the House of spills down to the community, and people end up fighting and killing one another because of what happens in the House. I think I would say that forum, Honourable Speaker, it's very important. It does help to cascade the message to all of us.
Thank you very much, Honourable Kubisa, for also bringing up that element. I think we've had a fruitful discussion on this matter, even if it's not conclusive, but the airing of concerns and the bringing up of various perspectives on the concerns, and also the ability for us to make the connection between us and our people in this regard, because it's also values that we are an embodiment of as members of Parliament. Our people send us here because they've got confidence in us and they hope that we will continue to represent the best that South Africa can be. So on those grounds, I close the particular discussion, noting that all sides have been able to express themselves and that we will yet give ourselves the maybe a future way of wrapping up the matter in terms of how do we handle it. The concerns are raised about presiding officers also applying the rules fairly, which calls on us as presiding officers to ourselves put our heads together to identify areas where perhaps we ourselves have not assisted the process. But I think as I close the matter, it's very important for us to make the differentiation between robustness and being offensive, abusive, and so on, and that we must always apply our mind collectively, that we must present that distinction in the way we handle these different situations. Honourable members, I really want to suggest that the two remaining items be kept for a future meeting. But if you feel that we should continue, it's okay. I see Honorable Sienaizen shaking your head very vigorously. Honorable Sienaizen?
Yeah, look, I think that item 7 should be devolved to the subcommittee to apply their minds to how we do many plenaries, and there's no rush on that, there's no urgency. But with respect, Madam Speaker, item 8 is really impacting on our ability as a House to perform its function.
Do you want to express your view on the item 8 so that we can hear out what
I
the
have,
issues
there
are?
There have been a number of discussions in the Chief Whip's Forum, as well as a number of concessions in the House, and it relates to where members' statements is put on the order of business. And I think that the executive, and maybe Mr. Kuhnhoff here, so he could also have some input into it. The executive might want to make input on this. The problem is that member statements are now right at the end, and by the time we get to the end of the program, they are often, a handful of ministers in the House, and so those opportunities are not being fully responded to, and the relevant ministers themselves are not in the House. And it's understandable, as a member of the executive, you can't really spend the whole day from 2 to 6, 7, 7.30 p.m. sometimes in the House because you've got executive responsibilities, and we accept that. And so I think that the request was that we look at whether we can change in the order of proceedings members' statements up to near the front of the business, and even maybe moving motions up there, because it then allows the ministers to interact and then leave if they need to. They can then go and attend to their duties. Now, I know why it was done in the past was because there was the issue around filibustering, but that really doesn't play a role anymore because there are a limited number of motions and a limited number of member statements. So we can't go over, you know, the party allocations in both those instances. So the fear of a filibuster is frankly moot now because it doesn't exist anymore. But I think it will help both the executive and would lead to a far more meaningful engagement with ministers and the executive with the issues that members of parliament want to bring to the House on behalf of their constituents.
May I ask that the subcommittee processes this matter so that we don't get into it because we will probably take the next hour. Subcommittee, Honorable Mtakane, I'm sure you agree. I see also you nodding quite robustly. Okay, Honorable Members, with that, agreed to, can we agree to close and go and have the lunch that is outside for which we have paid?